scent of pine trees in the air. Never knew a day so fair. It makes you feel so proud that you could cry.
As Perry Cairo sings, smell of pine trees in the air, never knew a day so fair. And that's because the bluest skies in Seattle have always paired so nicely with the city's groves and forests. And it just so happens that our resident historian Felix Bunnell is here with news of a book that's just been published all about our beloved street trees.
Yes, this new book, it's released just yesterday. It's called Street Trees of Seattle, an Illustrated Walking Guide. I went out the other day with author Taha Ibrahimi to look at and talk about street trees. A couple things first. Now, street trees mean trees in the right of way, like the parking strip between the street and the sidewalk. Or it could be a tree in someone's yard, but that extends out over the sidewalk or the street. That's a street tree. Now, these aren't hidden away. The trees in this new book are all very accessible to everyone. Second thing, what I like about Taha's approach, something we've run across before, this is where a passionate person compiles and interprets data to create order and communicate a sense of history and place. You might remember in the past we profiled the guy who wrote histories of every single post office that ever existed in Washington, or there's a family down in Oregon now in its third generation of compiling the origins of every single place name in that state. This book fits into that category and belongs on your shelf next to those books. Now, these resulting books aren't just data. They tell a story. They give you a guide to see things for yourself. So in talking with Taha Ibrahimi the other day, she said there's something about Seattle trees that most people don't know that goes back to the 19th century.
Most of Seattle was clear cut, and only 5% of our street trees are native to this region. So most of what you see everywhere is planted and brought from somewhere else. So there's a lot of layers of history behind the trees here. And I'm also interested in data. And when I found the publicly available data set from the city, it was fun finding out which ones were the widest trees and things like that.
Now, she mentioned the data set. That's information about street trees that the city of Seattle began compiling back in the 1950s, which they really picked up speed on in the 1990s. Now, from that data, that's where Taha was able to identify rare species, unusual species, and exceptional trees like the tallest or the widest. Now, tallest is pretty easy to understand, right? The notion of widest, says Taha Ibrahimi, it needs a little bit of explaining.
Anytime I meet a tree person, the first thing they ask me is, like, what do you mean by widest? You know, and some people measure a tree by the drip line, like the ends of each branches. Some people measure a tree by the circumference of its trunk. But the standard way, apparently, is to measure the diameter. So you get the circumference, you calculate the diameter, and you have to do it from 4.5 feet up from the ground. And that is called diameter at breast height. And 4.5 feet is the standard breast height. And there's even an acronym, DBH.
And don't worry, this won't be on the midterm.
I'm taking notes.
Now, the place you met up is the giant Wedgwood Rock at 28th Avenue Northeast. That could be a story all unto itself. But this is giant glacial erratic as big as a cottage. Now, standing right next to the Wedgwood Rock is the second widest Atlas Cedar in Council District 4.
So you can tell the Atlas Cedar by these short needles, and they're in bushels along the branch. You see that? Instead of coming out of the branch. And I see some male cones here, but they usually have these upright kind of round cones, and I don't see any in this tree right now. I'm looking around. I see no evidence right now.
I love that the tree data is by council district, so it's like you can vote for your favorite tree. I like the old at-large days. Anyway, now, Taha's new book, it's not a catalog or a dry database on paper. She's got backstories of all kinds of different trees. She's drawn all these sketches. She's a very talented artist. You could sit and read it, you know, from cover to cover. You could use it to take a particular walking tour or just dip into it anywhere and read about one particular tree or neighborhood. Now, we did a bit of a whirlwind driving tour of Northeast Seattle. We saw that Atlas Cedar by the Wedgwood Rock, then a giant monkey puzzle tree. We saw a giant oak tree that overhangs an entire intersection, just incredible tree. Then we popped down a little side street to visit a tree Taha hadn't actually seen in person before, a giant sequoia, which to her surprise and delight turned out to be a weeping giant sequoia.
Oh my God, it's so weird looking. It's right here. Oh my God, it's so cool. It looks like a Muppet.
Yeah. Oh. I thought it kind of had a Dr. Seuss quality to it. It's one of these, it just looks like a branch kind of coming out of nowhere. It's just really curvy, crazy trees. Now, trees have been in the news a lot around here lately. You know, the Seattle City Council has that tree ordinance. It's confusing a lot of people. There's people protesting to protect trees from construction projects. The unfortunate removal of the old cherry trees at Pike Place Market last year. Trees clearly touch a nerve for a lot of people. And Taha says, you know, based on the reception to this book, and it's been everywhere, this book, there's so much excitement about this book. We do love our trees in Seattle, but she says we're not really seeing the big picture, not seeing the forest, you know, let's say, of other important issues related directly to trees, and why we should be more focused on taking care of trees in Seattle, because they take care of us.
Most of all, I think, like, the mental health well-being benefits that they found are really, really amazing. Being within 320 feet of a tree gives you a better life expectancy and a lower chance of being prescribed antidepressants. And there are just, like, so many studies about it. It's overwhelming, you know? So if you imagine all these benefits, we're not calculating the cost of those benefits when we're thinking about trees. We're thinking of them as these things that are, like, easily replaceable.
You know, and I want to end this on a very Seattle moment. As I was standing there with Taha next to a tree, a man rode by on a bicycle. He turned his head toward us and obviously recognized Taha, so he stopped and he hopped off.
Who's that? Alec Duxbury, get over here. That's my old English teacher. I'm getting interviewed for Cairo. That's hilarious. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. This is Felix. Felix Bonnell. Okay, this is so Seattle. I hope you're recording this.
This was an English teacher who saw the future, you know, 25, 30 years ago, that Taha would someday write a book about something. This guy was, it was no surprise that Mr. Duxbury going by on his bike, it was a very Seattle moment. I'm glad I could share it and bring it to all of you.
This entire story, and I say this with all the love in my heart, her excitement and about dorkiness.
Yes.
I love that so much. Yeah. I love nerds who are excited about being nerds.
It's all about the data set.
Oh,
it's all about
so
the data
good.
Set. Yeah, and trees are great. You know, and the book's printed on paper. I pointed out that irony, but you know, sometimes you have to have trees that are sustainable that can be used for books. So it's a great book. I'm sure it's going to be set the gift world by storm this year. It's just one of the greatest recent books about Seattle history through the data, which is really cool.
And I always think when I fly back into Seattle how lucky we are that we have so many trees. Because I used
Absolutely.
To live on the East Coast, and you'd fly into cities there and you'd just be like, gosh, that's so barren.
Yeah, you take off, it's all brown, and you get into Seattle and it's all green. Yeah, no, it's a great thing for this city to have a book like this finally that lays it all out. And all these trees are publicly accessible. And you can just thumb through it, pick a tree you want, pick a neighborhood, and walk through it. It covers the entire city. A really cool book.
And you're so right. Each neighborhood had its own tree character, too.
Yep.
I think I actually feel it when I'm in a different neighborhood. We lived on Beacon Hill. We've lived in Montlake. And they're both very different tree neighborhoods.
Absolutely.
And I feel that.
Yep. And tonight, there's a kickoff event at Elliott Bay Bookstore for this Seattle Street Trees of Seattle Illustrated Walking Guide. And Taha's got all kinds of events she's appearing at over the next several months. Get out there and get the book. Get out and actually walk around and see the trees in person and appreciate what we have.
Love it. Felix Bonnell, thank you very much. Welcome back to Seattle. Morning News. This is Travis Mayfield in for Dave Ross, along with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Let's get an update on the current situation in Gaza from CBS correspondent Linda Gradstein, who is in Jerusalem. Linda, let's start with where things stand when it comes to a response from Israel to Iran.
Well, Israel says it is going to respond, but it seems that that response is not going to be immediate. And the sense that I get is it's not going to be such a large response that it would drag the Middle East into a war. The missiles Iran fired, 300 missiles at Israel early Sunday. Israel went on high alert, canceled schools, things like that, and then lifted those restrictions the next day. So it seems, and, you know, Israeli officials continue to say that they will respond, that they will respond when they choose to, but the tensions seem to have calmed down.
And what about the public sentiment in Israel at this moment on this issue?
Well, I think that, you know, people are a little bit torn because on one hand, they feel that there should be an Israeli response, that, you know, Iran should not be able to. It's the first time that Iran has fired missiles directly from Iran rather than using a proxy like Hezbollah in Lebanon or Hamas in Gaza. And, you know, a lot of people say there has to be some response. At the same time, Israel got sort of across the board international support, and cooperation beyond support from the United States. Jordanian fighter jets actually shot down some of the missiles. So I think Israel doesn't want to jeopardize that international support at the same time as it wants some response.
And what are we hearing from the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, not much, actually, surprisingly, you know, given he's the person who has spent, you know, so much time in his career trying to, you know, saying that he's the one who can save Israel from the Iranian nuclear program. He has not said very much. The calls for a response have come from people in the War Cabinet, former chiefs of staff, things like that. But he's been very quiet. He made one very brief statement right after the attack, and that was it.
So since the U.S. did help intercept some of those drones and missiles, has that changed any of the perception toward the U.S. from, you know, the political establishment or even the public in Israel, since things have been a little rocky with our relationship in recent months?
Right. Things have definitely been rocky. I mean, you know, Israelis, both the public and the government, certainly welcomed the U.S. support and the close cooperation. And I think it was sort of a reminder to Israelis that the United States does basically support the state of Israel and that its criticism of Israel's conduct in Gaza does not mean that the U.S. is abandoning Israel or anything like that. So I think actually it came as sort of a relief to a lot of people because Israelis are certainly not happy about the growing tensions with the U.S.
I'm wondering where ceasefire discussions stand at this moment.
Yeah, well, the prime minister of Qatar said a few minutes ago that hostage talks are at what he called a delicate phase, and he said they're trying to overcome stalling. Apparently, the United States had come up with a bridging proposal, which Israel had accepted. Hamas has rejected and has made a series of demands that are really not acceptable to Israel or the U.S. One of the issues is that in the first stage of a ceasefire and hostage release, 40 hostages, women, older people, people who were sick were supposed to be released. And now Hamas says that it only has 20 people who fit that criteria, which is raising a lot of questions in Israel about how many of the hostages who are still there are still alive. And so that's kind of causing, you know, a pall and a lot of sadness. And Hamas has refused to provide a complete list of who's still alive.
And the UN is kind of considering this $3 billion aid idea for Palestinians in Gaza. Can you tell us any more about that and what it could do?
Well, first of all, Gaza has been almost completely destroyed. I mean, 80% of the buildings have been damaged or completely destroyed. People are living in tents. There are 1.5 million Palestinians crowded into the southern Israeli city of Rafah. So the aid would be to both, you know, immediate aid and also to rebuild Gaza, which is going to take a long time. The problem is that Israel has said that the Palestinian Authority and certainly Hamas can have no role in that. So it's not clear who would be doing this, how it would work. And it's also not clear what's going to happen but in the short term to these, you know, to the 2.3 million residents of Gaza.
CBS News correspondent Linda Gradstein, who is in Jerusalem this morning. Thank you very much for your time, Linda.
Sure.
Welcome back to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Colleen O'Brien. Today we have someone in the studio who's doing what a lot of us think about, fantasize about, leaving our 9-to-5 and pursuing a passion. Nat Henry is behind a new interactive map that shows the walkability of Seattle neighborhoods and so much more. I'm oversimplifying it here. Nat, welcome to the studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this started as a love for your neighborhood, Capitol Hill, and a desire to map out how easy it is to walk to places like grocery stores and cafes. How did that begin for you?
That's right. I live in Capitol Hill. And for me, I'm so pleased to be able to walk 5 minutes and get to a bookstore or a grocery store or to the local elementary school. And so I was wondering for myself what other places in Seattle were like my own neighborhood and somewhere where I could live and walk to the majority of my trips. So I ended up making this map just out of my own personal interest to see where I could live. And the map basically shows you have a different set of destinations that you can select. So you could select things like dentists, grocery stores, convenience stores. And the map will show you the time it would take to walk to the farthest of those destination types. And so if you select, you want to be within, you know, 5 minutes of five different things, you can find those neighborhoods where you'll be within a 5 minute walk of all of those destinations.
You must be in some sort of data input coding. This must be a skill of yours to be able to create a map like this so easily. Now, I say it was easy, but was it?
Well, my background is as a professional geographer. And so some of this work is my bread and butter.
Okay.
I had to find data for all of these different locations across the country. And there's all sorts of different data sources that don't always agree with each other. And so that was the biggest part of creating the map, was putting these together and figuring out, you know, which one can be the source of truth for each of the different destinations.
How does somebody find your map online?
They can go to close.city.
Okay, let's get that out of the way, because I also want you to describe what the map looks like. It, to me, when I'm looking, it looks like a radar, how you might see heavy rain and in red and orange and light rain and blue. Yours does the same thing with colors. Can you describe that for our listeners?
That's right. So when you select your set of destinations that you're interested in, you can always toggle and say, maybe I care the most about supermarkets, so I'll just start with supermarkets and then add destinations one by one. And as you add different destinations, you'll see the map change colors. So colors that are sort of a dark blue through green are 5 to 15 minute walks with the average walking speed. And then colors that are a little bit more oranger to darker red are the areas that are 15 to 30 minutes. And everything outside of a 30 minute radius is in sort of more of a gray color.
Where you don't want to live.
Well, if you want to walk to places.
That's
maybe.
True. I guess it's where if you want to walk to places. So what did you find about your neighborhood, Capitol Hill? And then what else revealed itself as you grew this map outside of where you live?
So I think that people wouldn't be surprised to learn that areas like Capitol Hill, downtown Ballard, places like North Beacon Hill are all very walkable, and you can meet most of your daily needs within a 5 or 15 minute walk from many of the blocks in those central neighborhoods. But there were also some neighborhoods that kind of surprised me, and those really were spread across Seattle. So there were some areas in White Center, some areas in Bitter Lake, north in Seattle, and even places like Madrona that you think of as fairly small neighborhoods actually have, you know, one of each of the services that you might want for your daily needs. And so I think what I found was that depending on what you want, you can actually live in several different neighborhoods around Seattle. And of course, there were some other neighborhoods that were surprising that are these very dense built up areas that we think of in South Lake Union or in Belltown. You know, these are some of the densest neighborhoods in the city, but they don't have the elementary schools. They don't have the public libraries. And to get them, you either have to go across downtown or walk up Queen Anne Hill. And so it's a real question for, as we're starting to think about, you know, planning for the future and planning for more people coming to Seattle, you know, how do we build those neighborhoods where people can get to everything they need without necessarily needing to get in the car?
Yeah, this plays into this urban planning model I was reading in the initial Seattle Times article about you, a 15-minute city, that this is what the ideal for developers to create 15-minute cities now. What does that mean?
Yeah, I think this is a new take on a concept that's been around for a long time. The idea that we should have areas of our neighborhoods that are denser, that are sort of this feeling of place and this feeling of being in the center of your neighborhood, and also diverse in terms of land uses. So you maybe have your public spaces where people can gather and also your daily needs, but also maybe that's interspersed with some housing for people who want to be right in the center of all that. And so that's, you know, there's a question of whether 15 minutes is the perfect cutoff. And so for some people, it'll be more like 5 minutes. For some people, it might be up to 30 minutes. But I think that we can start thinking about those concepts when we're, you know, trying to find new amenities or trying to build new housing for all the people who are coming to Seattle.
What information has come to you since creating this map that informs you about why certain Seattle neighborhoods are not as walkable as they should be? Is it zoning?
Yeah. So when people think about the amenities that are available to them in their neighborhood, zoning is the number one determinant of what people can and can't do when they want to add an amenity or be close to a park. And so zoning is sort of a big factor in that decision. And zoning is governed by this comprehensive plan. So by state law, Washington every 10 years has to update its, or rather Seattle every 10 years has to update its comprehensive plan and basically lay out a vision for how the city is going to grow and change over time. And if 5 years from now you want to open a supermarket in your neighborhood and you found interested investors and you're ready to take the leap, you also have to go to the city and say, does this fit into the guidelines that were laid out in this comprehensive plan? And so it's really this guiding document that's going to shape how the city grows over time. And what I found was that often these neighborhoods, you know, when places are zoned commercial, those areas are sort of built out. You know, all the amenities that can fit in those places are often available, especially in those residential neighborhoods. And so I think there is sort of this pent up demand for more walkability and more density to amenities. And I hope that's a challenge that the city planners are taking on as they think about growth over time.
I'm curious if anyone from Seattle has reached out to you to say, hey, can you help us?
So the map is actually national, and I have gotten some interest from other cities, especially sort of the mid-sized cities who say, thank you so much for making this map. You know, no one thinks of us as a walkable neighborhood, but you can see we actually do have the seeds of something available here. And that's true for some small towns with downtowns as well. But no one in Seattle has yet reached out to me. And I hope that it's a concept, even if they don't use the map themselves, maybe they create their own version of it and think about, you know, what are the amenities that are necessary? Mm-hmm. You know, another thing we should think about is there's sort of this chicken and egg problem of the density that is required to support certain amenities and then the desire to have those amenities in place before we build. And so Seattle is considering in its next comprehensive plan these neighborhood centers, which will be just small pockets of commercial retail that will then support the surrounding neighborhood so that more people can take walking trips to get to those amenities instead of driving to a different neighborhood.
It is Nat Henry, and your website again, close.city. Close.city. You can visit it now to find the walkability near you. Now time for the Daily Dose of Kindness, brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. A Utah boy's stolen scooter has turned into a kindness initiative in his community. Recently, Lincoln Neff went through a bit of a tough loss for a 7-year-old. One of his prized possessions went missing, his scooter. His mother, Nicole, told Channel ABC4 in Utah.
My sweet boy got a scooter for Christmas just a couple months ago. I took him to an appointment and we forgot that he had the scooter at school.
And when they got back, his beloved scooter was gone.
I was just like crying and I was super sad.
Nicole posted on Facebook to see if anyone had seen the missing scooter. And after that, she received a message from another woman on their community page
saying that her son had passed away in 2022. She had a scooter that's been in the garage ever since. And she would like to give it to my son, Lincoln, because she felt like it was time for another kid to enjoy that scooter.
So Nicole and Lincoln went to meet the woman. When she gave him the scooter, Lincoln had a message to share with her.
I said, I'm sorry about him. Like, I'm sorry about what happened. And she said, it's fine. But this scooter also means something. Like, it's pretty good.
Now, thanks to an act of kindness from a stranger, Lincoln has a new scooter and a few new tricks.
A tail whip. I can do it. I can do it. That's a double tail whip. Might have been a triple.
Double tail whip. The Neffs are hoping to pay that kindness forward by doing one kind act a day.
So we've been doing kind acts every single day of April, trying to hopefully make a little bit of influence on our kids to just be kinder and spread goodness.
And it all started with a scooter that got a second chance to bring a child joy.
Joining us now from the G and Ursula Show from 9 to noon here on Cairo News Radio, G Scott. So, G, good morning.
Good morning, Travis. Good to see you,
always,
man.
Always good to see you as well. I love you. You always make me smarter on all the issues.
Well.
But let's talk about sports because that's what I really need to be smarter about.
All right.
We're talking about the NFL draft.
Yeah.
I was still kind of like glowing about the WNBA draft, which was like fun to watch and I loved all the excitement. But we have to keep our eye on who the Seahawks are. I have no idea who the Seahawks want.
Okay, let me just tell you this. You, anyone listening right now, me, football experts, they don't know either.
Okay, all right. I feel better then.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I'm just going to tell you, I have a source that tells me that the Seattle Seahawks. No, you don't. No, you don't.
How do they keep it on such lockdown?
I don't know. It's the most amazing thing.
Yeah.
I have been connected with this organization for 21 years.
Yeah.
Not one.
Not one.
Not
week.
One time have I even got remotely close. So when I see the experts say, well, I was talking to, and I got a source that said, no, you didn't. No, you did not. Right? And I know some things.
Yeah.
I've never come close because they really take that serious. Now, my job is to tell you who I think the Seahawks are going to take.
Yeah, all right. Let's do it.
So, first things first, they need to address the offensive line. That's going to be the first thing. And you're going to hear a lot of NFL teams talk about addressing the offensive line. And then the next thing they'll say, they need to address the defensive line. Mm-hmm. And the reason why they need to address those things is because that is the most important positions on the football field, right?
It's how you play football.
Right.
If the trenches.
The offensive line isn't good, Your quarterback isn't good. If the offensive line isn't good, your running back isn't good. Like, those things, like, other people's positions are dependent upon those things. So the Seattle Seahawks have done well in the last couple years with the draft. They had Abe Lucas and, of course, had Charles Cross. Those were rookie tackles that they had a couple years ago. They are pretty good, but they need to work on the interior of that line right there. So I think that they'll do that. UW, a local tie, Troy Fontano, he was really good offensive lineman. The Seahawks have the number 16 pick, so who knows? Maybe he's around it that way. But again, I'm telling you right now, just because I'm saying that, that's a good chance that the Seahawks won't do that. You know what I mean? So I'm not even close.
What about Michael Penix Jr.?
Yeah, Michael Penix Jr., quarterback. I just don't think he's going to be available, one. And two, let's just say that he was. Let's just say that Michael Penix Jr. is available at number 16, which Seattle Seahawks have. What does everyone think? You guys think that Michael Penix Jr. would be someone you would want to pick to come in right now and replace Geno Smith?
Not to replace. I mean, as a backup.
As a backup, right? So, sure. Usually when you pick that first round pick, usually you want that first round pick quarterback to be someone that you kind of see as someone that can come in and play. One of the things I've known is that everybody always likes the new person. Everybody likes the new kid. Everybody likes the
opportunity.
Or the new husband or something like that. You know what I mean? They're like, I'm tired of this husband. Let me at least bring in another one for a backup, right?
If only, right?
Colleen, could you imagine that? I'm just gonna have a backup, and you look at your current husband, and you're like, hey, just so you know.
You know what? The last thing I need is another husband.
Are you good?
I'm good. I'll be my own husband if things don't work out.
All right. Well, you know, like I said, the draft is going to be happening next Thursday. Looking forward to that. I get the opportunity to host a draft party for the Seattle Seahawks.
And where's that?
I knew you were going to ask me that, and I thought about not saying it.
You don't have to tell us if you don't want a crowd. I mean, we know how popular
Queen
you are.
Queen Anne Beer Hall or something like that. One of those little spots.
Yeah.
I'll get that answer
Watch
to you
G's
before then.
Social.
So anyways, I'm looking forward to it. And I think that the Seahawks are coming in. They got new coaches this season, right? I have not met the new coaching staff, not one coach. I haven't met the head coach yet. So I'm looking forward to doing that. So Seahawks season is really kind of underway. The players got back a couple weeks ago. OTAs are starting. But the NFL draft is going to be next Thursday. And try to guess who they're going to pick. I'm going to say an offensive lineman.
All right.
But probably I'm going to be
probably
wrong.
Probably not.
So don't call me back to be your Seahawks expert ever again.
Okay. All right.
Never.
I apologize. See y'all.
It is 8:48 now on Seattle's Morning News. Colleen O'Brien, Travis Mayfield with us through the end of the week.
Yeah.
Always good to have you here, my friend. How important is walkability for you in a city? I know that's big for you.
You
love your walkable neighborhood.
I love a walkable. The 15-minute neighborhood, the like walk anywhere, get what you need. Love it.
And you have that. It's great
for
kids, too. I spoke with Nat Henry, a former UW researcher turned entrepreneur who created an interactive walkability map of neighborhoods in Seattle. And for Nat, the importance of walkability goes beyond simple convenience. For him, it has to do with the city's carbon footprint.
Right now, Seattle's car pollution is the number one source of greenhouse gas emissions in the city. And the majority of that is personal vehicle trips, so not necessarily bus trips. And when you think about who is using a car to get where, people commuting to downtown, only about 20 of them drive alone to get downtown. When you're outside of downtown, that goes up to about 40% of people. But then 75% of people say that they use cars just to get to their daily needs. So your supermarkets and your elementary schools and your doctors. Mm. And so if we could find a way to make our sort of areas that we live more friendly to, you know, to walkability, we might be able to have people saying, you know, maybe we don't need that second car for the family, or maybe we can just walk this trip instead of driving it. And I think that at the aggregate, that would make a really big difference for the city.
I think if people haven't lived or traveled in a space where that's available to them, I think Europe does this really well. If you've ever traveled there, typically wherever you're set up, whether it's an Airbnb or a hotel, you're walking everywhere to get your groceries for the week, to see something, to go, you know, pick up this or that. It's very walkable. And then you come to America, especially suburban America. I mean, you live in Capitol Hill. That's a given. You're going to be able to walk. But for the suburbs, it's all car. You can't get anything done, especially if you have kids, unless you have a car.
Yeah, that's right.
At least not easily.
And I think that we've been talking about the density of amenities, but there's also all sorts of infrastructure that has to be built out. You know, people have to feel not just like they can get to their destination, but that they can do it safely, they can do it enjoyably. You know, they're not being buzzed by traffic that's going 60 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. So that's also a conversation where you need to have not just, you know, the city planners, but also the Department of Transportation and think about, you know, can we have our safe intersections and crosswalks as well?
And sidewalks. I was reading, too, that one of your challenges in building out this map nationally is that some data is not available, like the data of where are sidewalks.
That's right. So I do have some sidewalk data in the map. When you zoom in, you can see the sidewalks and paths that are available through open source data. But not all cities make their sidewalk data available. And often, even if the sidewalk data is there, it won't tell you the condition. So for someone who might be a wheelchair user, sidewalks that are narrow or that have big tree roots running through them might be totally inaccessible. So I think that's another dimension that will be a really exciting opportunity to sort of overlay that data on a city by city level with the walkability information.
What's your next step with this map? How are you going to grow it and make it into your full-time job?
So my favorite thing about the map is that all of the data is available in the open. So you can see not just your walkability, but also the destinations nearby. And I'm using Cunningham's Law here, which this is from someone who was sort of the father of the wiki software that underlies Wikipedia. And he said, the best way to get the right answer on the internet isn't to ask a question. It's to put the slightly wrong answer on the internet.
Very smart.
I've gotten all sorts of responses from people saying, actually, you missed the one corner store in my neighborhood. Or actually, you know, you should think about adding these smaller parks in my city. And so my first step is just to make the map as trustworthy as possible, incorporate all that data, add the new data sources that people found. And then I'm hoping to release this as a tool that people can use for data downloads. So to be able to find, you know, add your own overlay of things like noise pollution or air pollution or safety. And so that'll be available in the coming months. And also I'll be releasing new features in particular cities. So I'm going to be doing consulting work on top of this.
Wow.
So if you use the map, again, close.city, and you see something where there's a great opportunity in your own city, I would love to talk.
Wow. So you're almost open sourcing your map now, would you ever allow people to come in and make changes themselves, or is this all at your hand?
Right now, there's actually a reporting feature in the map. And so if you see a location that's incorrect, you can click on it and follow the little alert button. And there's also an option to report a missing destination. And so those updates, I have to review them all at the moment. But at the moment, I'm updating on a weekly basis. And so if you report something one week, the next week it'll be in the map.
So you studied to be a geologist, and now you're almost a city planner. Would you call yourself that? Did you ever see this in your future?
So I've done some work. You know, geography does sort of overlap with this whole like city and regional planning concept. But I did take a detour through health, and I'm really excited to, again, bring back those skills, because that was all about statistical modeling and thinking about, you know, how do we take data at the small scale and really create insight from it. And so I'm also really excited to bring in that side of my background and to really think about what are the factors that underlie really healthy, vibrant neighborhoods. That's another next step that I'm really excited for.
Well, I'm excited for you. Thank you for joining us this morning. It is Nat Henry, and your website again, close.city. Close.city. You can visit it now to find the walkability near you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.